Memphis was a city of pharaohs, an ancient center of Egyptian religion and regal power, and the place where Alexander had been crowned king. This had been Egypt's first great city in what even then was the distant past. Legend had it that it had been created by the founder of the old kingdom, Menes, close to the necropolis at Saqqara, where the first pyramids had been built. Since then, its fortunes had waxed and waned, having lost its role as capital in 1300 BC, and having only recently returned to prominence under the Persian satraps. But for Ptolemy's purpose, what Memphis had in its favor was history. When the funeral procession of Alexander wound through the gates, it was entering a city that was already 2,750 years old. The presence of his body here announced that he had been a legitimate heir to the pharaohs who had built this place, that he had supported the priests of Ptah here, that he had honored the Apis bull, Egypt's most sacred animal, who lived here, and that he had respected the ancient temple system that ran the country. His burial in an Egyptian-style tomb was also of the greatest importance. This spoke to Egyptians, telling them that Egypt, long-suffering, invaded, and despoiled Egypt, was what had mattered most to Alexander, and that the greatest general for centuries, perhaps of all time, had known that his spiritual home was here in the greatest of ancient civilizations. That alone proved to them that he must have been born of the Egyptian gods, and reminded them that they were once, and would be again, a great nation. But Ptolemy did not intend to leave Alexander in Memphis. This ancient city in the Delta was not ideally suited as the capital of the type of modern state he had in mind, and the monolithic religious presence there might prove stifling to his plans. Though he wanted to rule Egypt in a way Egyptians understood, this did not extend to being a puppet of Egyptian officials and priests in Memphis. No, the site for his new capital had to be Alexandria. Not only had this place been selected by the divine Alexander himself, but it also fulfilled Ptolemy's strategic and cultural requirements. Ptolemy needed a capital that had access to the Mediterranean world, the Greek world, which could dominate trade and diplomacy as well as grant a military advantage against enemies. He needed a port which had access to Egyptian wealth and that of the world beyond. Ancient Egypt had often been an inward-looking culture, suspicious of foreign contact. Ptolemy intended to plug it into the Greek world and in the process reinvent it. There were also purely military considerations. This Egypt was not going to be part of a greater empire. Ptolemy had seen firsthand how difficult it was to rule vast territories with their huge cultural differences. He instead chose a place with one cultural identity, but he would have to defend it from the other heirs of Alexander who still believed in Alexander's dream and would, no doubt, attempt to bring Egypt back into the fold. As Egypt's wealth was the Nile Valley, this meant protecting the country's flanks, setting up buffer zones in the east and west to prevent attacks across Sinai or from the other city-states along the Libyan coast. For this, Alexandria was ideally situated, so he urged its builders on. The man charged with laying out Alexander's city was Dinocrates of Rhodes, who hence takes his place as the first in that long line of Alexandrian scholars. He had the task of following with surveyors where Alexander had once strode with barley flour, placing temples here and palaces there with a sweep of his hand, and turning that vague idea into functioning reality. As the city's planner, he devised a design based on the principles of the great Greek architect Hippodamus of Miletus, the man who had been employed by the Athenians to build their harbour at Piraeus. Hippodamus had been a flamboyant character, if the none too flattering sketch furnished by Aristotle can be relied upon. Hippodamus, the son of Europhon, a Milesian, contrived the art of laying out towns. This man was in other respects too eager after notice, and seemed to many to live in a very affected manner, with his flowing locks and his expensive ornaments, and a coarse warm vest which he wore not only in the winter but also in the hot weather. Aristotle, Politics. Despite these affectations, Hippodamus and his school were held in high regard when it came to planning towns. For them, town planning was about much more than just laying out public squares and markets. For them, the job of an architect also included suggesting how a town should function, what the structure of its government should be, and how its citizens should work together for the common good. Aristotle, in a more generous mood, tells us that Hippodamus was the first who, not being actually engaged in the management of public affairs, set himself to inquire what sort of government was best, and he planned a state consisting of 10,000 persons divided into three parts, one consisting of artisans, another of husbandmen, and the third of soldiers. He also divided the land into three parts, and allotted one to sacred purposes, another to the public, and the third to individuals. Aristotle, Politics. He even seems to have gone as far as suggesting the rudiments of a welfare state, when he made a law that those should be rewarded who found out anything for the good of the city, and that the children of those who fell in battle should be educated at the public expense, which law had never been proposed by any other legislator, though it is at present in use at Athens as well as in other cities. Aristotle, Politics. Of course, Hippodamus had rarely had the opportunity to build a city from scratch, having instead to change towns piecemeal and persuade their inhabitants of the merits of his ideas. At Alexandria, however, Dinocrates had a clean slate, and as he paced the burning sand, he must have thought of not just how to build a city, but how to make it work as well. The physical system Dinocrates built was based around a grid of roads, each cell of which was then to be filled in with housing, public buildings, and royal palaces. This gridiron provided the maximum road access and commercial frontage, while also allowing for privacy within each cell. It was a simple but hugely innovative design, forgotten in the modern world until recent centuries. Today, of course, it is a plan that forms the backbone of some of the greatest cities on earth, from Tokyo to New York. The most important work, however, was to create the two sea harbours, and for this major engineering work was necessary. This took the form of a 600-foot-wide mole, or causeway, stretching between the mainland and the island of Pharos, which divided the bay in half. As this land bridge was 7 times the length of a Greek stadium, around 4,200 feet, it was known as the Heptastadion. The Heptastadion was cut and bridged at its top and bottom to allow shipping to pass from one harbour to the other. To the east was the Great Harbour, running from the Isle of Pharos, over the Heptastadion, along the coast, and out via another promontory, the Lochias. Across its narrow neck lay dangerous reefs, making the approach extremely difficult, but inside the harbour, shipping was almost entirely protected from the elements. For a ship finding passage into this haven, an extraordinary new vista now opened up. Ahead lay the tiny island of Antirrhodos, with its own miniature royal harbour, and embracing this, the walls of the harbour proper, where the palaces, apartments, and gardens of the royal quarter spilled down to the edge of the sea. Here the still blue waters ran so deep that even the largest ships could tie up at the walls without fear of grounding. To the west lay the port of Eunostos, in the curve from the other end of the Pharos across the Heptastadion and on to the mainland coast. With its wide mouth it made for an apparently much easier approach from the sea, but again the harbour opening was littered with reefs and shoals, making sense for any sailor of the port's name, Eunostos, the port of good return. From here there was also a canal cut across to Lake Mariotis. Finally, there was a third, very small sea harbour on the far side of the island of Pharos itself, known as the Port of Pirates, suitable for small fishing boats perhaps, but, thanks to a string of rocks across its entrance, of no use in Dinocrates' magnificent plan. Nor was the name purely fanciful. The inhabitants of Pharos and the users of her harbour retained something of a reputation for piracy, even as the city began to thrive, and ships approaching and leaving port were warned to give the island a wide berth. To provide water for the city, another canal stretched from the Nile near the town of Canopus to great underground communal cisterns in the city. For those fortunate to be living in the wealthier sections of the city, the larger private houses were fitted with their own cisterns, giving their owners the unique advantage in a desert land of having fresh water on tap. Nor were the inhabitants of Pharos forgotten, and an aqueduct carried water for the island from the Nile Canal through the city and across the Heptastadion. Within these boundaries, it was Dinocrates' task to fit this perfect city, and the results were spectacular. Imagine the traveller whose ship puts in at Alexandria's great harbour in these early days. He would walk along the new wharves and pass south through the Gate of the Moon into the city itself. Ahead lies a 101-foot-wide boulevard, known later as the Street of the Soma, or Body, after the mausoleum of Alexander and the Ptolemaic kings that stood on its flank. Down each side, the dazzling white of marble colonnades leads the eye to the southern gate of the city, the Gate of the Sun, and glittering beyond it, the waters of Lake Mariotis. Here, Nile transports, laden with Egyptian grain, might be seen tying up alongside the marsh harbour, while distant sails carry Greek treasures away to the Nile Valley. Walking down the granite-paved street, our visitor eventually comes to the major crossroads where the great east-west canopic way intersects the Street of the Soma. In years to come, this will be the chaotic, noisy heart of the city, filled with street philosophers, tradesmen and hawkers. But for now it is still quiet. To the left, along the way in the far distance, stands the canopic gate, beyond which a dusty road leads east toward the Nile and Old Egypt. To the right, the colonnades stretch out to the necropic gate at the threshold of the City of the Dead. Beyond lie the gardens and embalming houses in which the inhabitants of this city will be buried in centuries to come, a silent other world of incense-laden air and voiceless mausolea. Along both these streets and the grid of smaller roads that spread out from them, plots are already being divided up. There will be a theatre and a stadium, a riding track, a gymnasium, and a host of temples and shrines. The large space needed for the hippodrome will have to be found outside the city limits, beyond the canopic gate, while the royal quarter will quickly fill with ever more lavish palaces and lodges. Other wonders, too, would soon come to Alexandria, but with the building of the Heptastadion and the laying out of the main roads, the fundamental plan of the greatest city in the ancient world was complete. Plutarch, in his Life of Alexander, commented that the overall shape was, appropriately enough, like that of a military Macedonian chlamys, the Macedonian short cloak, gathered in the middle between the Mediterranean and Mariotis and splaying out to east and west. Long before the lighthouse shone out from Pharos, before the foundation of the library or museum, before even Alexander's body was entombed in its marble and rock crystal vault, his city was already a miracle. The flour and sand had become marble and granite. The people who gazed out from their new marble porticos in the nascent city were as varied in origin and wealth as the peoples Alexander had conquered. The city had been laid out not in three classes, as Hippodamus had suggested, but in three main ethnic districts. The original village site of Rakotis became the native Egyptian quarter. The Bruchium was home to both Greek immigrants and the Greek rulers of the city, and a Jewish quarter was populated with both local Jewish residents and traders, and a large population, some reported as 100,000 people, of captives, brought here by Ptolemy after he had conquered Jerusalem. Later, other districts would follow, but already this blend of European, African, and Near Eastern peoples was unique. We have no contemporary description of the early city, but later travellers visited and described what this seed would become. Strabo, a Greek geographer, whose name is actually an insulting Roman term meaning squinty, visited the city during Julius Caesar's lifetime and recorded how by his time every space within the plan laid out by Dinocrates had been filled with buildings. The city contains most beautiful public precincts, and also the royal palaces, which constitute one-fourth or even one-third of the whole circuit of the city. For just as each of the kings, from love of splendour, was wont to add some ornament to the public monuments, so also he would invest himself at his own expense with a residence in addition to those already built, so that now, to quote the words of the poet, there is building upon building. All, however, are connected with one another and the harbour, even those that lie outside the harbour. Strabo, Geography. But if it was the whim of Alexander that had founded the city and the will of Ptolemy that made it his capital, it was something more powerful than both of them that made it a success from the start. The reason people from across the ancient world were settling here was trade. Alexandria was rapidly becoming the entrepot of the world. Sited between two harbours, the city stood at the crossroads of the ancient world, where the fine art and technology of the Greek city-states could be traded for the vast food resources of the Nile Valley, the treasures of Africa, and the luxuries of Asia. By the time Diodorus visited, sometime around the middle of the 1st century BC, it was unsurpassed. The city in general has grown so much in later times that many reckon it to be the first city of the civilized world, and it is certainly far ahead of all the rest in elegance and extent and riches and luxury. The number of its inhabitants surpasses that of those in other cities. At the time when we were in Egypt, those who kept the census returns of the population said that its free residents were more than 300,000, and that the king received from the revenues of the country more than 6,000 talents. Diodorus Siculus, Library of History. Alexandria was a commercial success, and once the body of the hero himself was installed as its centerpiece, it would gain an electrifying additional significance. It would become a city of God. While Alexander's great plan seemed to be coming together, Ptolemy's place in succeeding to this patrimony was by no means yet certain. Ptolemy's retiring to Egypt with the body of Alexander sent out a clear message to any Macedonian generals who might dispute the succession. If Perdiccas or anyone else wanted to reintegrate Egypt into that empire, he would now have to fight Ptolemy for it. Egypt was hence the first fragment to fall away from the Macedonian Empire, beginning a sequence of collapse that would lead to years of internecine warfare. But in the last remaining days of peace, there was one other problem in Egypt to clear up. It was time for Ptolemy to turn to that other festering sore, that other dangerous reminder of the old times. Cleomenes of Naucratis was still a powerful official in Egypt, and still the man in charge of funding the building of Ptolemy's new city. But as that dream came to fruition, so the potentially dangerous Cleomenes' usefulness was coming to an end. It was perhaps an old face from Ptolemy's childhood, Aristotle, who suggested the solution. Cleomenes had somehow come to Aristotle's attention, and in the great man's economic treatise, Economica, he describes at length some of the Hipparchus's more unusual methods of raising funds. In one instance he threatened to attack the sacred crocodiles who ate one of his servants, forcing their priests to produce a large quantity of gold in order to buy off his wrath and so protect the sanctity of the reptile. In particular, Aristotle reports the unique approach he took to funding and filling the new city of Alexandria by persuading the inhabitants of the nearby market town of Canopus to move to the city. Sailing therefore to Canopus, he informed the priests and the men of property there that he was come to remove them. The priests and residents thereupon contributed money to induce him to leave their market where it was. Cleomenes was not about to forego a substantial bribe, so he took the money and left the inhabitants of Canopus in peace, at least for a little while. But in fact, the residents of the city had just bought some time while the finishing touches were put to Alexandria. Then Cleomenes returned and proceeded to demand an excessive sum, which represented, he said, the difference the change of site would make to him. They, however, declared themselves unable to pay it, and were accordingly removed. Aristotle went on to list numerous other cons, tricks, and elaborate extortions by which this rather faithless financial adviser lined the imperial pocket and his own. Whether this information had come to Aristotle from Ptolemy, or whether it was common knowledge, is unknown. Perhaps Cleomenes felt invulnerable enough even to boast of his financial achievements. If he did so, however, he was a fool, for Aristotle was writing his death warrant. Perhaps, standing in front of the beautiful city now growing up around him, Cleomenes thought his work, his reputation, or even his money could protect him. He was quite mistaken. In fact, making money, his great talent, would be his undoing. His sharp financial practices had been overlooked for years by rulers eager to line their own coffers, but Ptolemy now turned with righteous indignation on the man who had built Alexandria for him. The financial wizard who, more than any other person, had actually turned Alexander's orders into architectural reality was charged with embezzling the staggering sum of 8,000 Egyptian talents. To put that into the context of the day, it was enough money to have paid one of the laborers building the city for over 66,000 years. It was also, of course, a charge which undoubtedly had a certain ring of truth to it, even if Ptolemy had massaged the exact figures. As a result, Cleomenes was tried, found guilty, and promptly executed. It was another astute move on Ptolemy's part. He had removed a dangerous and wealthy rival, and at the same time made himself hugely popular in Egypt for bringing justice to bear on a man who had bled the country dry. But Ptolemy had no intention of returning the money. Alexandria was built, the population was moved, and the money in the state and Cleomenes's coffers would now be at his command. It was a most fortunate situation for Ptolemy, and he needed good fortune, for war was coming. Alexander would have wept to see what followed his death. Perdiccas, his old friend, could not stand by quietly while provoked by Ptolemy. Ptolemy had Alexander's body and was clearly carving out a piece of his empire for his sole use. And so, in a vain attempt to hold together the whole idea of a unified empire, the regent attacked Egypt with the full might of the Macedonian army, Indian elephants, mahouts, and all. But his high-handed arrogance and his failure to appreciate the impossibility of ruling this vast, messy collection of conquests alone would prove his downfall. Although others of the friends and companions of Alexander marched through Sinai into Egypt with Perdiccas, not all of them still believed that the empire could be maintained. Fewer still believed or wanted to believe that it should be maintained by Perdiccas. Thus, the army that burst into the eastern delta was not the happy, all-conquering band of brothers that had only recently fought its way across Asia to India. On reaching the Nile, Perdiccas ordered his army across the elephants in the front, then the shield-bearers and ladder-carriers who were to be the vanguard of his attack on a fort known as the Fort of Camels. However, Ptolemy was not far away, and he and his army dashed to the fort and quickly took up positions prepared to repel the assault. At once the shield-bearers set up the scaling ladders and began to mount them, while the elephant-borne troops were tearing the palisades to pieces and throwing down the parapets. According to Diodorus, who describes the scene, Perdiccas did not use his war elephants with the tactical brilliance of his old master, and seeing a weakness, Ptolemy personally seized the initiative. Ptolemy, however, who had the best soldiers near himself, and wished to encourage the other commanders and friends to face the dangers, taking his long spear and posting himself on the top of the outwork, put out the eyes of the leading elephant, since he occupied a higher position, and wounded its Indian mahout. Then, with utter contempt of the danger, striking and disabling those who were coming up the ladders, he sent them rolling down in their armour into the river. Diodorus Siculus, Library of History. His men followed suit and began targeting the Indian mahouts, leaving the elephants out of control and useless, although Perdiccas sent wave after wave of attackers, having the advantage of numbers. The battle and Ptolemy's personal heroics lasted all day, but in the end Perdiccas was forced to call off the assault and retreat to his former camp. Ptolemy was victorious. We don't know Diodorus's source for this episode, but the wild heroics of Ptolemy himself suggest it was somewhat biased. In fact, Ptolemy had delayed Perdiccas long enough for something far more powerful to come to the rescue. Doubt. Perdiccas had failed to cross the Nile, and now the whispering campaign began. Ptolemy had secured a jewel for himself, something manageable, defendable. Why shouldn't Alexander's other old friends do the same for themselves? Forget the greater empire, forget Perdiccas, and seize something tangible for their own. And so they did. In the late spring of 321 BC, a mutiny broke out among those same Macedonian troops who had once conquered the world, and Perdiccas' own officers assassinated him. This would not bring an end to the wars among Alexander's heirs, but it did mark the end of the idea that any of them could rule everything their old master had. By the end of the fighting, which lasted until nearly the end of the century, Alexander's dreams lay in ruins. His mother, wife, half-brother, and infant son all murdered. In their place stood three families. In Greece and Macedon, the Antigonids would rule the old homeland. In the Asian satrapies, the descendants of Seleucus, who had been one of the assassins of Perdiccas, would govern this part of the former Persian Empire. While in Egypt, Ptolemy intended to found his own dynasty. Ptolemy had set the tone for the new order in Egypt, and, fired by the same drive that had taken him and his master to the Indian subcontinent, set about subduing the city-states of North Africa. By 321 BC, the wealthy but isolated city of Cyrene, lying between Egypt and Tunisia, had fallen to him. As one of Alexander's conquests, it was a state Ptolemy rightfully felt was his for the taking, having only recently come under the rule of a Spartan adventurer in the chaos following Alexander's death. But in retaking the city, he showed himself to have learned from his master's diplomatic mistakes. He did not replace tyrant Spartan rule with a dictatorship of his own, but with a liberal constitution. Under the Ptolemaic constitution, the state was to be ruled by 10,000 privileged citizens arranged into two councils, and a popular court, in a plan not dissimilar to that proposed by Hippodamus. He did not go so far as to let the Cyrenians think they could rule themselves alone, of course, appointing himself as their guardian in perpetuity. In an age which celebrated outright conquest, this defensive imperialism was not only novel, it was successful and sustainable. Ptolemy pushed on farther west, beyond Cyrene, to take control of the profitable trans-Saharan trade routes, bringing gold, ivory, and slaves from Central and West Africa. To the east and north, he seized Palestine and parts of Syria, as well as Cyprus and the Aegean islands of the Cyclades. This gave him control of lucrative trade routes, but, more important, created a buffer zone where he could contest disputes with his Persian and Macedonian rivals, leaving the Egyptian heartland stable and free from warfare for generations to come. Ptolemy had been the only successor to Alexander not to want to inherit that whole empire. He did not want new territories, just enough friendly or subject states around him to protect the core of his plan, Egypt. He had taken a dependent satrapy and forged it into an independent nation. The physical structure for the Ptolemaic age was now in place. It simply needed to be brought to life.
Chapter 3. Egypt Reborn.
Egypt has more wonders in it than any other country in the world, and provides more works that defy description than any other place. Herodotus, The Histories.
During Ptolemy's lifetime, the body of Alexander was not the only god resting in Memphis. Apis, the bull god of the city, was, at least to the native Egyptians, easily as important as the mummified remains of the conqueror of the world, and the representation of this deity was a living bull kept in its own temple and treated with the respect due to the earthly manifestation of a god. It was a peculiarly Egyptian idea. The Apis bull had been a powerful symbol in Egypt since the very first dynasties well over 2,000 years earlier. Originally, it had represented the power and will of the pharaoh himself, later being thought to represent the god Ptah, whose center of worship was at Memphis. By Ptolemy's day, however, the animal had come to represent the incarnation of Osiris, the lord of the dead, who was usually depicted in human form, wrapped and mummified for burial. According to Plutarch, the bull was then the living aspect of this dead god, or, as he put it, the beautiful image of the soul of Osiris. To Egyptians, the presence of this living creature was a manifestation of a god on earth, more holy than the sacred cows that walk unmolested through the streets of Indian cities. When the bull died, the whole of Egypt went into 70 days of mourning and fasting, during which time the carcass of the huge animal was mummified and prepared for a lavish funeral. The body was then carried down the Sphinx-lined processional way from Memphis to the great funerary complex at Saqqara, where some of the earliest pharaohs had been buried. Here the line of sphinxes directed the mourners to a temple and catacomb where the dead Apis, now known as the Osiris Apis or Serapis, would be laid to rest, the Serapeum. Today, the majority of the site lies buried deep under the sand, something that was already a problem in 24 BC when Strabo paid a visit.
"One finds a temple to Serapis in such a sandy place that the wind heaps up the sand dunes beneath which we saw sphinxes, some half buried, some buried up to the head, from which one can suppose that the way to this temple could not be without danger if one were caught in a sudden windstorm."
Strabo, Geography. After Strabo, the sands seemed to have continued to pile up, and the complex disappeared from historical view for 1,875 years, until, in a scene that could have come from a children's adventure book, the French archaeologist Auguste Mariette stumbled upon those same sphinxes that Strabo had recorded disappearing beneath the sand.
Did it not seem that Strabo had written this to help us rediscover, after over 18 centuries, the famous temple dedicated to Serapis? It was impossible to doubt it. This buried sphinx, the companion of 15 others I had encountered in Alexandria and Cairo, formed with them part of the avenue that led to the Memphis Serapeum. Auguste Mariette, A Serapeum de Memphis. The tantalizing line of sphinxes led to one of the most important funerary sites in Egypt, into the presence of animals whom the Egyptians at least believed to be gods. Mariette was transfixed by thoughts of what lay beneath his feet. Undoubtedly, many precious fragments, many statues, many unknown texts were hidden beneath the sand upon which I stood. And it was thus, on the 1st of November, 1850, during one of the most beautiful sunrises I had ever seen in Egypt, that a group of 30 workmen, working under my orders near that sphinx, were about to cause such total upheaval in the conditions of my stay in Egypt. Auguste Mariette, La Serapeum de Memphis. What Mariette found as he dug was that the line of sphinxes led to a sand-filled courtyard in which sat one of the most exquisite Egyptian statues in existence, the squatting scribe. Beyond this, behind a rock fall of rubble which he removed with explosives, lay seemingly endless subterranean galleries cut into the living rock beneath Egypt's oldest pyramids, which had once contained the mortal remains of the Apis bulls. Each one had been buried in a giant sarcophagus, cut from a single piece of granite and weighing 60 to 80 tons. Inside had lain the doubtless bejeweled and gilded bodies of the bulls themselves, though Mariette noted that all the coffin lids had been pushed aside and the remains robbed. 2 millennia before, in the time of the Ptolemies, few would have dared enter the catacombs where Mariette now walked, and none would have disturbed the sleep of the recently deceased Apis. After their lavish, almost pharaonic, burial, word would have gone out to the priests that a new Apis had to be found, and the Nile Valley would be scoured in the search for a calf born under just the right circumstances. Herodotus says the priests were looking out for the calf of a cow which is never afterwards able to have another. The Egyptian belief is that a flash of lightning descends upon the cow from heaven, and this causes her to receive Apis. In practical terms, this meant a black calf with a white diamond on its forehead, an eagle on its back, a scarab mark under its tongue, and double the usual number of tail hairs. When such an animal was found, there was rejoicing through the country because the living god had returned to them. The calf's mother was immediately revered as the Isis cow, while her calf was transported down the Nile to Memphis, housed in a golden cabin on its own bark. From now on the bull would live like a king, appearing to an adoring public during the 7 days of the annual Apis festival, being led through the crowds by his priests. It was said that a child who smelled the breath of the Apis would be granted the gift of foreseeing the future, as the bull was an oracle. Those without access to such a fortunate child could ask the bull itself about their future by holding out food for it. If it took the offering, then their future was bright. If it refused, then the omens were bad. To the Greek Herodotus, this worship of a farmyard animal seemed strange, to say the least. Although the Greek gods might take on animal form when it suited them, there were no sacred animals in their pantheon. Most Greeks had enough trouble with the idea of a living human taking on the characteristics of a god, as we've seen in their response to Alexander's claim of divinity, so a living animal god was simply ludicrous to them. But antagonizing Egyptians' millennia-old beliefs was a foolish undertaking, as Ptolemy well knew. The Apis rituals were a link with that unimaginably long Egyptian history that this country's people held so dear, and Ptolemy saw that this could make or break his attempt to rule successfully here. Herodotus went on in his description of the Apis cult to describe how the hated Persian rulers of Egypt had mocked the cult. Their king, Cambyses, had heard of the birth of a new Apis and demanded that this living god be brought before him. The priests of Apis had duly done this, but when the priests returned bringing Apis with them, Cambyses,
like the hare-brained person that he was, drew his dagger and aimed at the belly of the animal, but missed his mark and stabbed him in the thigh. Then he laughed and said thus to the priests, "Oh, blockheads, and think ye that gods become like this, of flesh and blood, and sensible to steal? A fit god indeed for Egyptians, such a one! But it shall cost you dear that you have made me your laughing stock."
Herodotus, The Histories. The humiliated king was true to his word, and ordered the priests of Abis whipped. Then, according to Herodotus, he went about dismantling the whole cult, instituting the death penalty for any Egyptian found celebrating the Apis festival. But the real damage had been done to the sacred bull itself. Apis, wounded in the thigh, lay some time pining in the temple. At last he died of his wound, and the priests buried him secretly, without the knowledge of Cambyses. The Egyptians were very clear about what happened next. The crime drove Cambyses mad, leading him into a downward spiral of events. He is said to have murdered his own brother and sister, who was also his wife, while his attempt to intimidate the oracle at Siwa led to his losing an entire army in the desert sands. Eventually, he received a self-inflicted sword wound in his thigh in exactly the same location where he had wounded the Apis. It became infected, and he died. But more important than Cambyses' fate was the survival of this story among the Egyptians. The moral of the tale they had recounted to Herodotus was one of a bad foreigner ignoring their ancient rituals and hence, quite rightly, coming to grief. Egyptian records actually show that between 525 and 522 BC, Cambyses was involved in the dedication of the sarcophagus of the dead Apis, implying that the story Herodotus was told had been made up by his Egyptian sources. But what mattered was that Persian rule had been a humiliation, and in the Egyptian consciousness this could easily be equated to the maltreatment of an Apis bull. Alexander had also been a foreigner, but in lifting Persian dominion he had gained favour in Egypt. To keep that favour, however, his successors would have to walk like Egyptians. All of this was known to Ptolemy as he prepared the final parts of his plan for a new Egypt. Back in Alexandria, the first phase of Alexander's, and now Ptolemy's, dream was nearing completion. In the Bruchium, the great wealth of Egypt had been put to good use, building palaces suitable for her new ruler. The mud brick of the early buildings had been encased in polished stone and alabaster. The Ptolemaic household was furnished with chairs and beds in the Egyptian style, carved from cedar of Lebanon and inlaid with ivory from equatorial Africa. Outside, royal parks with their marble fountains and shimmering lakes proclaimed the largesse and power of this pharaoh in all but name. But that was just the problem. Alexander had already been a great king when he appeared in Egypt, and the confirmation from the oracle at Siwa that he was a son of Amon told the Egyptians everything they needed to know to crown him pharaoh. For Ptolemy it was different. He could declare himself a Greek king, a basileus. Indeed, that was an essential part of making his claim to Egypt as one of the successors of Alexander. But that title meant precious little to the Egyptians he intended to rule. And regardless of what esteem he held those native people in, he knew that they drove the economy that would make or break his dream. What Ptolemy needed was a means of combining Greek and Egyptian religious traditions in a way that would leave him a king in Greek eyes, but a god in Egyptian ones. No mean feat when one considers the trouble Herodotus had coming to terms with the differences between their cultures. But in the Apis bull he saw an opportunity, and he seized it. His plan was to create a new cult, one that combined elements of Greek and Egyptian practice and symbolism that would serve to tie together seamlessly the fates of the Greek rulers and their Egyptian subjects. It would clearly be extremely difficult to impose himself upon ancient native beliefs, and equally the Egyptians were unlikely simply to throw away thousands of years of religion to turn to Greek beliefs. But if he could invent a new religion that combined the two, then he could insert his family into the heart of it, granting them the godlike rights due to the heirs of Alexander and the heirs of the pharaohs.
To do this, Ptolemy needed the help of local Egyptian priests and Greek thinkers, and he was quick to foster connections between the two. He began by encouraging Greeks to write Egyptica, Egyptian histories, which drew on the centuries-old traditions of the priests of Memphis and Thebes. Of course, this required the active cooperation of those priests. The historian and skeptic philosopher Hecateus of Abdera, who accompanied Ptolemy on a Nile journey as far as Thebes, was one of the first to take up the challenge, and he tells us that Ptolemy ordered the priests to provide the facts from their sacred records. Another papyrus document from around this date, known as Hebe Papyrus 27, records in Greek how the writer spent 5 years as a disciple of a wise man, almost certainly an Egyptian astronomer priest, who taught him how the Egyptians measured time with an instrument called a gnomon, a staff for measuring the length of shadows cast by the sun. Clearly the lesson was well learned, for within 100 years a Greek scholar at Alexandria would use this simple tool to make a far more spectacular measurement, the circumference of the earth. This cultural exchange program between Greek and Egyptian scholars had a number of benefits. Not only did it provide Ptolemy with detailed information about how Egypt was run, but it gave his Greek academics access to the centuries of scientific, particularly astronomical and religious thinking of the Egyptians. It also encouraged exchange the other way, helping to Hellenize the priestly caste in the temples and make them look more favorably on Greek rule. One such Egyptian who would prove vital in Ptolemy's religious plans was Manetho. Manetho was an Egyptian high priest in Heliopolis, one of the ancient cult capitals of the country since the days of the pyramid builders, which lies today engulfed in the urban sprawl of Cairo. He was also a historian, which gave him added benefits when it came to legitimizing Ptolemy's rule. Indeed, the chronological lists of pharaohs used by Egyptologists today is still based on one drawn up by Manetho, one which seamlessly integrates the Ptolemies, of course. The plan the two devised was to create a new cult based in the temple that stood over the tombs of the Apis bulls, in which a personification of those dead animals could be worshipped as Osorapis, a fusion of the god of the dead, Osiris, and the living bull, Apis. The results must have sounded thoroughly Egyptian, but it was in their interpretation by Ptolemy and his Greek-influenced helpers that we begin to see how the fusion was enacted. The great cult statue of Serapis was commissioned by Ptolemy from the Greek master sculptor Bryaxis, who, with 3 others, had been responsible for a side each of the mausoleum at Halicarnassus. His Serapis was represented not in Egyptian form, with combined human and animal elements, but as a benign, bearded man, seated on a throne and wearing the crown of fertility, the Modius. To represent his power over the dead, the power of Osiris, the three-headed dog of the Greek underworld, Cerberus, crouched at his right knee. In his left hand he held aloft a wand similar to the staff of the Greek god of healing, Asclepius. In fact, his image must have looked remarkably similar to Zeus. But this was Zeus imbued with thousands of years of Egyptian religious power. To the Greeks, he could easily be seen as a Greek god ruling an alien land. But to the Egyptians, his outward appearance was simply a new manifestation of the age-old truths that Egyptians and Egyptians alone had always known. Ptolemy wanted not only to establish this Greco-Egyptian cult as quickly as possible, but also to locate its center in his new capital, Alexandria, away from the powerful influence of the old temple administrations. It must also have seemed appropriate that this new city should have its own new and unique god protecting it, housed in a temple which bore the same name as the last resting place of the Apis bulls, the Serapium. But the inhabitants of Alexandria, Greeks, Jews, and Egyptians, would require some convincing. To do this, Ptolemy not only had to call on the right people to support his idea, but had to frame his new deity in a way that appealed to the eclectic audience of his new city. As such, the new god Serapis had to combine many of the best features of a number of gods. Importantly, he was cast as a god of healing, a deity who had a practical everyday value that would bring him into the lives of anyone who was, or knew someone who was, sick. This power was indicated by his Asclepius-like staff, which indicated to the Greeks this facet of his being.
For the Egyptian audience, he was equated in this to Imhotep, the supposed architect of the first pyramid, who was later worshipped as a god of healing. He was also given some of the personal appeal of Asclepius in that it was said that he was a god who came privately to people and spoke to them in their dreams. He was thus someone who could be appealed to personally, rather than simply through the offices of a priestly caste cut off from the normal population in the forbidden realm of the Adytum, the exclusive priestly inner sanctum. These healing powers and his association with the dead Apis and hence Osiris, god of the netherworld, also gave him different powers that would appeal to the Alexandrian audience. He was a god who stood outside the realms of fate, beyond the fickle chances of the everyday world. He was a god who had beaten death like Osiris. As such, he could see into the future and hence could be appealed to as an oracle, a hugely popular idea in both the Greek and Egyptian worlds. Creating another oracular center in Alexandria would be a real coup, bringing wealth and prestige to the city, perhaps making it a place to rival Delphi or Siwa, and granting whoever controlled it, namely Ptolemy, enormous power over those who might make important political decisions based on its pronouncements. But there was a danger that all these powers made the new god seem a somber and frightening character, particularly to the Greeks. The Egyptian and Greek attitudes to death stood at extreme ends of the spectrum, so a unified god of death had to tread carefully. In the Hellenistic world, the afterlife was a dull, grey place, a dusty land of regret, where the dead looked back in sorrow at what they had and hadn't done in life. For the Egyptians, it was quite the opposite. Egyptians looked forward to death as a time and place where the very best in life was made eternal. Planning for death, building tombs and preparing grave goods, was not a solemn undertaking but often a hobby, something to be done in one's spare time and enjoyable. They did not wish for death, but knew that after death, when they had, in the idiom of the day, gone to the West, all that was good in life could await them there, provided they had prepared carefully beforehand. To compensate for the negative image that Serapis's associations with death created in Greek minds, he was also cast for them as a Dionysian character. He was an ebullient, festive god, filled with life and the love of life, who indulged in banquets and festivals. A Bacchic figure who, in the knowledge that a Greek afterlife was much less fun than an Egyptian one, encouraged his followers to seize the day and enjoy this life to the full. In short, he was all things to all men and women. If the Alexandrians still needed persuading, Ptolemy had another weapon in his armory, philosophers. Demetrius of Phalerum had been a philosopher of the Peripatetic school, a pupil of Aristotle and an Athenian statesman. His 10-year rule in Athens had brought peace to the city until its invasion by one of the heirs of Alexander forced him from power and overseas to Alexandria. He arrived here with an extraordinary reputation as a thinker and a politician, the protector of Athenian liberty, the regulator of her laws, and a fine orator and writer. As such, he was later to play a key role in turning Alexandria into the center of the ancient world. But before any of the real work began, Ptolemy wanted him to support the new cult of Serapis, and Demetrius seems to have been glad to help. The story that went around the city shortly after his arrival was that he had been struck blind. This, of course, was a disaster for Demetrius, Ptolemy, and Alexandria. But good news followed rapidly on the heels of bad when the announcement was made that through a miracle his sight had been restored. And how had this miracle come about? He had simply prayed to the new god Serapis, in his role as god of healing, and Serapis had done the rest. To celebrate, Demetrius then put his considerable lyrical skills to use in composing the first of his paeans, in which he demonstrated his gratitude for the god's intervention. There is, of course, a chance that events happened exactly as the story said, but the arrival of an old friend of Aristotle's at Ptolemy's court at this time, in need of friendship and protection, but with an astute and practical knowledge of the politics of the Hellenistic world, was perhaps more likely to have been a public relations opportunity too good to miss. Nor was Demetrius the only Greek thinker to be held up as an acolyte of Serapis in an attempt to persuade the Alexandrians. One of the most popular Greek cults of the time was the Eleusinian mystery cult of Demeter and Persephone. the annual festival in Eleusis, near Athens, was considered to be one of the most important in the ancient world, and, as with all cults, the secrecy which surrounded it attracted adherents by the thousand. Central to these were the five clans whose families had, so the legend had it, from the first provided the priests who administered these undisclosed rites. Ptolemy managed to persuade one of these clan members, Timotheus, from the Eumoplid family, to support his new god Serapis. Backing from such an important official must have influenced Alexandrians and Greeks throughout Egypt, and not only that, but as Timotheus's own cult was a secret, there would never have to be an explanation of how the truth of Serapis had been revealed to him. With Serapis established, Ptolemy could now make his final move, the final political maneuver that would ensure that his Egypt would become the only true legacy of Alexander's dream. His city was nearing completion. His religion was in place, or at least beginning. It was time to make his last great gamble and bid for the throne. For some time, Ptolemy had been preparing his Egyptian subjects for an announcement. He had been encouraging his family to live in a more overtly Egyptian manner, adopting Egyptian modes of dress, attending traditional rituals, and even going so far as to contemplate the father, daughter, and brother-sister marriages which had been common among the great dynasties of the new kingdom some 700 years before. He didn't want to be seen by his new hosts as a foreign ruler, another Cambyses. It was not, however, simply going native. Egypt offered his family some things money could not buy, history, tradition, and a civilization so old that it made the Hellenistic world look like an afterthought. But he also had something to offer it. He was holding out the prospect of Egypt's becoming the center of the world once again. Ptolemy had a dream of a new kind of city and country, a place of universal knowledge where the thoughts of the greatest minds could be turned to the creation of the perfect state, under the benevolent eye of a dynasty of rulers who would gain wealth, fame, and immortality from their patronage of this greatest of human projects. If Ptolemy could cherry-pick the highlights of that ancient culture and fuse them with the modern thinking of his Greek world, then he would be more than both. He would look like an Egyptian, but speak like a Greek. Indeed, he and most of his descendants refused to learn the Egyptian language. He would be something new, the founder of not just a new dynasty, but a new kingdom. And so the final logical stage in Ptolemy's progress from childhood friend of Alexander to Pharaoh was put into motion. As the new cult of Serapis was built up in Alexandria, so the traditional role of Memphis was run down. Along with the decline in religious importance, the main arms of administration were also moved from the old capital to the new city. From here, the state was reorganized. Registers of houses, land, slaves, cattle, and taxpayers were ordered to be drawn up in every village, then summarized, and returned to what was now officially the new capital, Alexandria. Then, in early 304 BC, Ptolemy set the seal on his achievements by sending out another declaration to the people of Egypt. The days of Persian domination, of foreign domination, were in the past. Egypt had awoken, stirred by a new leader. He was to be no longer their satrap, but their savior, Ptolemy Soter, the first in a new dynasty of Greek pharaohs who would oversee the greatest explosion in thought and innovation the world has ever known, and its heart would be Alexandria. Chapter 4. The Legacy of Aristotle. All men by nature desire to know. Aristotle, Metaphysics. If it was Egyptian religion and Macedonian tactics that placed Ptolemy on the throne of Egypt, it would be Greek thought that kept him there. The state he envisaged ruling was unlike anything else in the ancient world, a country of the mind built in an alien land from the rubble of Alexander's empire. Ptolemy simply didn't share Alexander's ambition to rule the world, as he had seen how hopeless the idea really was. What he did share with his old friend was glimpses of a way in which at least a single country might be governed. Ptolemy and Alexander had been close as children and young men. Indeed, the rumour in the Egyptian court was that the two men were half-brothers following a liaison between Ptolemy's mother, Arsinoe, and Philip II, after which she was quickly married off to the minor nobleman, Lagus. The story was almost certainly false, but it served the new pharaoh well to be thought of as related to the founder of the new city, and as a man in whose veins the blood of the god Alexander flowed. But what Ptolemy had learned of government in the Macedonian court had not come from watching Alexander's father, whose autocratic rule would end with his assassination, or from observing the increasingly tyrannical government of Alexander's final years. Instead, it came from the man whom Philip had employed to educate his son, and who had, by default, educated Ptolemy as well. He was Aristotle, one of the greatest thinkers of the ancient world, and it was to memories of his tutelage that Ptolemy turned when he thought about bringing his new kingdom to life. Aristotle had always been there in the background, in the calmer, more considered parts of Alexander's and Ptolemy's minds. And through this, his influence spread far beyond his own writings and into his pupils' actions. He informed Alexander's whole way of thinking, promoting a love of investigation and discovery, which not only drove the conqueror across vast physical territories, but encouraged his journeys into all areas of knowledge. Alexander was a great devourer of books, often running out of material on campaigns and frantically sending for more. He read histories, scientific treatises, the plays of Euripides, Sophocles, and Aeschylus, everything from his precious casket copy of the Iliad, as corrected by Aristotle, to the dithyrambic odes of Telestes and Philoxenus. He also liked to put his knowledge to use, as Plutarch describes. Doubtless, also, it was to Aristotle that he owed the inclination he had, not to the theory only, but likewise to the practice of the art of medicine. For when any of his friends were sick, he would often prescribe them their course of diet and medicines proper to their disease, as we may find in his epistles. Plutarch, Life of Alexander. So great was Aristotle's influence on him that, if we are to believe Plutarch, he was often heard to say that he loved and cherished his tutor no less than if he had been his own father, giving this reason for it, that as he had received life from the one, so the other had taught him to live well. It was an interesting distinction, two fathers, one for a physical life and one for the life of the mind, but it was a conception that would finally bear fruit not in Alexander's empire, but in Ptolemy's Alexandria. Ptolemy had his physical kingdom, his throne, his army, his defences, and in those he was the inheritor of at least part of Alexander's world. Now he would combine that physical inheritance with an intellectual one and create something unique. In this, Aristotle might claim to be the true father of Alexandria, closer than the rumoured links between Ptolemy and Alexander, and more a father to his pupil's city than to the man himself. Aristotle, the man on whose thoughts Alexandria's intellectual foundations, and hence the intellectual foundations of the whole Western world, were built, was himself a member of a great dynasty, connected not by blood or marriage, but purely by thought and reason. He was the heir to a revolution in philosophy, building on the work of his old master Plato, who in turn had built his philosophy on the foundations of his tutor Socrates, whom the 18th century classicist John Lempriere characterized as the most celebrated philosopher of all antiquity. Philosophers, literally lovers of wisdom, had guided and shaped the Greek intellectual world from at least the time of Pythagoras in the 6th century BC, but with the coming of Socrates, 469 to 399 BC, Plato, 429 to 347 BC, and Aristotle, 384 to 322 BC, came a subtle shift in approach. Whereas many of the early philosophical questions were concerned with the nature of reality, of the world and universe, and the role of the divine in the greater scheme of things, the new notion initiated by Socrates was more concerned with the philosopher's own role in the world, in how to live correctly and set an example for others. Ethics and morality began to extend the fundamental concerns of philosophy, and so philosophy became not simply speculation, but a practical tool of government and a cornerstone of civilization. As a young man, Socrates had distinguished himself as a soldier, fighting in three major battles and being decorated for saving the life of a wounded friend. These expeditions with the military were, however, the only occasions on which this unusually sedentary philosopher ever left Athens. After the campaigns, he led a highly ascetic life, going barefoot and without a coat in the winter. He had no interest in money or material goods, and claimed that he was not paid for his teaching,
though as he had no other means of financial support, this seems unlikely. Socrates was a controversial figure, with new and sometimes startling things to say, so he made enemies as well as attracted friends and followers. His methodology was to initiate a series of questions to an individual or a group to reveal the extent of their knowledge or ignorance, seeking to expose contradictions in their beliefs. This was all well and good when addressing pupils or followers, but when this method was applied to people who thought of themselves as important, perhaps even great, Socrates' proven ability to show that they in fact knew nothing easily caused offence. Writing in his Lives of the Philosophers, Diogenes Laertius explains, "And very often, while arguing and discussing points that arose, he was treated with great violence, and beaten, and pulled about, and laughed at, and ridiculed by the multitude. But he bore all this with great equanimity. So that once, when he had been kicked and buffeted about, and someone expressed his surprise, he said, 'Suppose an ass had kicked me, would you have had me bring an action against him?'" Diogenes Laertius, The Lives and Opinions of Eminent Philosophers. Not that Socrates initiated these dialogues out of spite or arrogance. He always maintained that his own philosophical strength was rooted in the fact that he at least knew that he himself knew nothing. He was merely frustrated that others thought they really did know and understand the world and each other. While his reputation grew, the oracle at Delphi declaring that there was none wiser in the land, so too his concerns with ethics and the right ways to live inevitably drew him and philosophy into the political arena, where, during a period of considerable political instability, he could hardly avoid being seen as taking sides. In the 390s BC, his enemies finally brought charges against him, alleging that he had corrupted the Athenian youth, made innovations in the religion of the Greeks, and ridiculed their gods. As was the practice in Athens, where there were no professional judges, Socrates was summoned to answer the charges before a full jury of 501 citizens elected by ballot. The jury expected Socrates to put up an eloquent, self-effacing defence and finally sue for forgiveness, but this went entirely against the grain of his moral philosophy. Instead, he challenged the whole foundation of the trial and the supposed justice upon which it was based. He complained that these were trumped-up charges supported by false witnesses, which was almost certainly true, and his eloquence almost won the jury over. In the end, he was found guilty by only 3 votes. The next step in this people's trial was rather unusual. Instead of handing down a set sentence for the crime, the jury was required to ask Socrates how he himself considered he should be punished. But Socrates was still not prepared to humble himself before his accusers, and perhaps buoyed by the close vote in the trial itself, he suggested that because he had so helped to develop the intellectual caliber of the people, he should be granted free meals for life and pay a very modest fine. The jurors were not in a joking mood, however, and the mocking of their judicial process turned them savagely against him. The motion to put him to death immediately was passed by 441-60. He was duly sentenced to death by drinking hemlock, though his execution was delayed for 30 days by a local religious festival. Pressed by his followers to change his mind, he is said to have exclaimed, "Would you then have me die guilty?" He died aged 70 in 399 BC. In holding firm to his beliefs to the point of death, Socrates had a phenomenal impact on the Greek mind and Greek civilization. The philosophy of Pythagoras had not concerned itself with how a society should operate, but after Socrates, philosophers would interest themselves in the state and politics. Their subject had taken on a moral dimension and become something worth dying for. Lempriere summarizes his achievements with admirable clarity. "The philosophy of Socrates forms an interesting epoch in the history of the human mind. The son of Sophroniscus derided the more abstruse inquiries and metaphysical researches of his predecessors, and by first introducing moral philosophy, he induced mankind to consider themselves, their passions, their opinions, their duties, actions, and faculties. From this it is said that the founder of the Socratic school drew philosophy down from heaven upon the earth." Lempriere, Classical Dictionary. There is one other aspect of Socrates' death well worth noting. This is simply that it happened at all. That a philosopher should be put to death for holding views and expressing them orally
he did not set his views down in writing, merely because they were different from currently accepted norms, attests to how seriously this new philosophy was being taken. Indeed, the shift in emphasis from metaphysical to moral philosophy, which Socrates pioneered, had the effect of making philosophy's subject area even more politically loaded than it had been, to the point where Socrates' immediate successors became actively engaged in working out the ideal form that not just individuals, but entire societies should take. 10 years or so before his death, it is said, Socrates had a dream one night. A young bird fell exhausted into his lap, and then in front of him it grew at great speed into a fully fledged swan and flew away. The next day, Plato appeared at Socrates' school and asked to enroll as a pupil. He stayed with Socrates right through until his death, though he says he was not present when his master swallowed the poison.
This is the end of the CD. The program continues on the next CD.